Welcome to Pyramid to Circles. This podcast is for the leaders and the change makers who have the goal of evolving their company, their department, their team towards more collective intelligence, more empowerment, more self-organization, but who are asking themselves how to make this happen, where to start, and how to get inspiration from others. Today, I receive a person who is at the forefront of agile organizations, someone I do look up for his long experience of working with teams and his very strong commitment to do what he does in order to create a better world. And welcome, Jeff Kamps. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. And thanks for having me here.
It's really nice to have you. I'm really looking forward. Just tell us, where are you located as we have this conversation?
Well, I'm right now at my home in Belgium.
Where exactly in Belgium or near which city?
In a city called Turnhout, which is in the northeast, close to the Netherlands.
All right.
Yeah.
Okay, we hear the Elizabeth accent from this area, maybe.
Yeah.
You have my French accent, so it's going to be this globish style. Yeah. So we had the chance to talk a few times before, but we never worked together. So it's also for me, I'm very excited to know you more. And we have kind of the same age. The same age band, and some similarities having founded our own companies. But I made my little research. I'd like to introduce you, and then maybe you complete me or correct me. So you're the father of two. You are the founder of a company, a consultancy called Eileen, that is based in Belgium, and that you founded 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. And as I understood, the purpose is improving work and make it more human and more effective at the same time.
Yes, yeah.
And you're an expert of sociocracy, of agile, but you're also passionate about human growth, about people growth, towards the awareness of
indeed.
And responsibility needed to create this better world together. That's something that drives you, so you would tell us about that.
Yeah.
You are also the author of a book called Sociocracy 3.0, the novel, that I very strongly recommend, by the way, very strongly. And we're going to talk about that, of course. You published this book 2 years ago, and it's selling pretty well. Congrats in different countries.
Thanks. Right? Yeah, and three languages in the meantime. Yeah,
I think in Dutch, in English, and
in German recently. In German. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So it's a manual for resilient, innovative, and more human organizations in which you explain the approach of sociocracy 3.0. It's an approach, it's a methodology, if I can say, but you bring it to through a story, a novel with characters who go through a transformation, and that transformation transforms them not only collectively but also individually. And that's so you brought different levels, different layers of complexity. It's not about the method, it's about what people go through. The questions they have and the challenges they meet as they do it. So I thought it was really well done.
Okay, thank you very much.
Anything you want to add to this short intro or complete?
No, it's very complete. Yeah, definitely. That's who I am and what I professionally live for. Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe let's start with the first question. Maybe what are you up to? What are the kind of projects you're working on currently? Just so we get a sense of what you're doing, like just right now.
Yeah, sure. Well, one of the projects that's ongoing is growing and nourishing Eileen, so the organization I'm in together with my colleagues. So that's part of my working time, let's say, going to Eileen itself, meaning taking care of it, keeping in touch with the colleagues, thinking about business development and growing it. So that's part of my work. And the other part is, of course, being with customers, which is almost always Belgian organizations, helping them usually to grow to more self-organization, to more agility, to grow into new kinds of leadership. And I'm the kind of coach that typically goes to organizations occasionally. I'm not the kind of guy that is in a certain organization for 2 or 3 or 4 days a week for a long period. That's not my strength. So I'm serving several clients at the same time, having occasional coaching conversations, workshop training sessions. So I think currently there's around 5 or 6 organizations I'm helping out simultaneously. Yeah.
And these people, why do they come to you or to Eileen with what kind of request or difficulties or challenge?
Well, the questions differ a bit, but they all get down to, we want to become better at delivering results on one hand, but at the same time by creating more engaged people and a more agile organization. So typically the questions are, can you help us to become more self-organizing? Can you help us to become more agile? Or we're into agile leadership. Can you help us? Or even can you teach us Sociocracy 3.0? Which I don't think is the good question, because there's always the why. Why would you want to use certain tools or instruments? And then we get to those questions. Maybe they want to engage their people more. Maybe the organizational structure isn't helping out to react spontaneously or fast enough to market changes. So it's typically those kind of challenges we're addressing. Yeah,
it's interesting you say that. We should not. It's really or like a consultancy or a OD, organizational development person approach to say we don't bring a method. We first ask questions.
No.
I think it's super important because today I see so many companies. I don't know if you. I guess you have the same experience that they want an agile practice, or they want that sociocracy maybe, or holacracy something. And I personally see a lot of risk there if you just go that way.
I agree, because and I don't mind them asking, because I do understand the question. Mm-hmm. They've heard about a certain tool or strategy and they think it might help them. So they ask for that. They go look for an expert. But I think we as organizational coaches should be mirrors in the first place. And mirror the question and say, okay, you're asking for a certain instrument, but why would you want to use this? Mm-hmm. What's it you want to reach with it? What's the challenges you're facing? Sometimes they say, well, maybe not Sociocracy 3.0, but we need a more agile culture. But even that, I would throw back at the first instance and say, great, cultures is great, but why? What should the effect be of that culture on your people, on your clients? I think it's very important to realize why you would want to go into a certain strategy or tool or instrument first. Mm. Yeah. And then usually the work we do together with partners and the organization itself always uses our entire backpacks of experience and tools and instruments. So it's never only agile tools or Scrum or Sociocracy or Holacracy or S3. It's never only one tool or one instrument that can really help organizations, in my experience.
So you have your bag of, you have your school box, your school box, your toolbox.
In a way, it's a school box at the same time, right? Because every assignment is also teaching me new stuff about myself and life. So we have our toolbox or our backpack. Yeah, indeed. Yeah.
And then from there, you really do your analysis, your understanding, and at the deeper level. I think you're also a coach, right? You're a trained coach. I remember that.
Yes. Yeah, I studied NLP, and then later I studied professional individual coaching, the life coach kind of work. I never did that professionally, but I did train it because I think it's I naturally grew into it. It was like a passion of mine 15 years ago, but I do think it's a necessary set of skills for any organizational coach to be able to ask the right question rather than to give the proper advice. Of course, we combine both in our work, but sharing expertise and advice, but mainly asking the right question is usually more powerful even.
So you lean on which side, towards the coach or the expert naturally?
It depends, right? Because if I'm teaching, I'm a very coaching kind of teacher, but then I'm of course sharing my experience and sharing my knowledge, and I might be teaching 60% of the time and bringing in reflection questions and having people do exercises and work and coach them 30 or 40% of the time. But that's in a training room. If the next day I'm with the same customer in a boardroom, then I'm the coach. Then I'm mirroring things, observing, calling out what I observe and asking questions around it. So then I'd be probably coaching for 80% of what I do. Mm. So I think it's a dance between these different, and there's more. You could be the coach, you could be the trainer, you could be the expert giving advice, you could be the observer only mirroring things, you could be the silent witness, you could be hosting. So there's many roles you could take as a facilitator. or as an organizational coach. And I think it's our job to dance in between these roles to whatever is serving the customer most.
I see very well the, I think everybody understands, the people listening to this are, many of them, I guess, are either helping organizations making their own transformation, or they are leaders and change makers in companies, and they are maybe leading or putting in place some kind of change and or thinking about it and thinking of how to get started. And they're looking for inspiration. And so everybody, I think, understand training. Everybody stand expert. I don't know if we all understand when you speak about coaching. Maybe we understand that facilitating, we understand observing, but like for instance, you would come in a, you would come in a, because we understand coaching in a sense of leadership coaching, or you know, in organizations, people get coached to reach an objective or to grow as a leader. But I think you mean something a bit different here. I think you. Can you explain a little bit what you mean by that?
I think it's good you point that out, because the kind of coach I was referring to is not a typical football coach or basketball coach who gives order to his players and helps them to become better. The kind of coach I was talking about is more the, let's say, the professional life coach or even therapist kind of coach who has no agenda, him or herself. So when I'm a coach, I don't have my agenda. I don't want the customer to do anything, or to, I'm not deciding on his or her goals. I'm not defining the agenda. So there needs to be a learning question from the client. He or she is probably experiencing some things that are not ideally, wants to learn to behave or think or act differently. And as a coach, I'm not there to tell him what to do. I'm there to listen, understand. And based on that understanding, maybe take a step back. The first thing I need to do is build up a good rapport or relationship. Yeah. So there's trust and safety. Then I listen, I understand, and I'm going to mirror back what I see without judging. I'm trying not to judge. It's not my life or journey. It's the client's journey. So mirroring back what we see and then asking questions to clarify things, to help the client become more clear. Not for me to learn necessarily, but for the client to learn more about what is it, what I'm currently doing, what are the effects of that, what's the goal I have in mind, what are obstacles in between, what are the different paths or strategy I could choose from. And I'm not choosing for the client. I'm helping the client identify what are the options, which route or experiment am I going to take, what resources or help do I need, how can I get that. These are kind of typical coaching questions.
The people you're working with are, I guess, in this journey of some change toward transformation towards agile or towards a new ways of working or new culture, as you said it earlier. And I guess you coach more the leaders, I imagine.
Yes.
So you probably are experienced with facing the what stops them, what is the most difficult thing for them as they embark in that journey. Because if you have those intimate conversation where you coach them, you must witness maybe or see some patterns across different companies and across, you know, in different leaders, that the challenge they meet are sometimes a bit related or similar. I don't know. I'm curious about that.
Yeah, maybe I should start by saying that I'm not. What's the word? I'm not the best one-on-one leadership coach, right? Mm-hmm. There's people doing much better job at that than me, even within Eileen, or definitely within Eileen. But I think at first sight, most of these obstacles seem to be outside of these leaders, in the organization, in the people, maybe in the board of directors, holding them back. So initially, typically the obstacles are placed outside of the client, or the leader I'm working with, or the team I'm working with, but because the same dynamics happen with teams. And then by mirroring that, asking questions and looking at other situations in life or work where they bump into the same kinds of external obstacles, I think one thing we are all learning or needing to learn is to look at what obstacles are within ourselves, within our thinking within the way we've grown up, survival mechanisms we've created over the years for good reasons. So you need to honor those, first get to know them, honor them, and then look at where do those internal mechanisms, where are they still helping me or maybe no longer helping me or not in all situations helping me. So I think that's the typical journey when we're coaching a team or a leader, is to, instead of looking for obstacles and solutions outside of us, ourselves, go looking for them inside of ourselves.
So you are working at two levels. You're working at what's happening inside of ourselves at a level. Uh-huh. You're helping the leader becoming more aware of that, or
exploring
the
yeah.
scenario that is at play as I'm doing this transformation in my company inside of my.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And do you do it also with other people or only with the leader?
When you say leader, I don't necessarily interpret that as the C-level people or the top-level managers. Definitely those are the kinds of leaders we would want to work with But I would say we typically work with anyone taking up some kind of leadership in the organization. Could be a formal hierarchical leader, but also typical change agents or people with natural leadership who don't necessarily have a hierarchical management function, but people that have some natural respect and leadership in the organization, together with the formal managers and leaders, of course. Those are typically the people we like to work with. Work with the willing is something we try to implement. So try to work with those people who are open for change, ready for change, asking for change. So don't push change onto people. I don't think that is our job as organizational coaches to push change onto people, but to help people that want to change or discover to what degree they want to change, to help them go into that journey. Yeah. And in the end, everyone should become more of a leader in an organization, right?
Yeah.
But initially, we typically work with the former leaders and some, let's say, natural leaders in the organization.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You say to me, when the first time we talked, something I really, only you told me that, because there is this assumption everywhere that there is one way.
Uh-huh.
And that is from, and that's why basically this podcast is called From Pyramid to Circle. So there is only, it's a one-way street from pyramid to circles. We should be from hierarchy to circle to something that is more decentralized. Like uh-huh. I had the last podcast was with Tom Tominson, the co-founder uh-huh. of Holacracy One. And so he said, I'm definitely a decentralist. And I think centralized power structure made a lot of pain to people, and they are limiting people, potential. Mm-hmm. So he sees potential of people and they want to unleash this potential. And therefore he believes that self-organization and decentralized organizations are the way for it. But you told me once that sometime you actually bring more structure, bring a bit more pyramid. It's like sometime organizations need a bit of structure and more,
uh-huh.
more. And can you maybe just explain that, how you view and actually like this perspective, to see it more like two polarities, and uh-huh. the need for balance rather than a truth that everybody should go this way.
Yeah, and I like the word polarities. And kind of going into one end of the spectrum or the other end always mm-hmm. has risks, right? Because then you're ignoring the potential of being at the other end.
Mm-hmm.
And typically, if we say from pyramid to circle, pyramid implies a power hierarchy of functions, managing other people in certain functions, etc. And I'm not necessarily saying that we should bring that back into organizations, but I see too many organizations or leaders assuming that less structure is better. And I don't necessarily agree, because structure brings clarity in organization about who's doing what can we expect of each other. Structure brings kind of like a focus on the central shared purpose of an organization. You, in a way, you need to structure an organization around the purpose. A structure also provides some kind of safety and comfort to people. They know their place, they know their area of work and responsibility. So I don't think structure is a bad thing. I do think that in general, a structure that is implemented by having a power hierarchy, with people having autocratic power over other people. Typically, that's not the best thing to have, or the direction, if you would say, to move towards. But I think when we first talked, I meant that throwing out all structure is usually a bad idea, and that finding the balance between what kind and how much structure do we need versus how could we provide more autonomy and freedom and responsibility to people doing the actual work. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of balance between these polarities. Yeah.
It's a balance between the polarities, and it's not a revolution. It's more, I would say, like an evolution or
yeah, well, it's an interesting...
Oh, you see that? You don't seem to agree.
An interesting question to which I don't have a definite answer, yeah, because maybe there isn't one, but which is better, steady evolution, like step-by-step small incremental improvements, or revolution that changes everything and creates a little bit of chaos? I don't know. I've seen both kinds of change. And I think depending on the situation and the context, I think both could really be beneficial to an organization. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm not going to call out names because I didn't ask permission, but there's one, let's say, larger, more traditional organization in Belgium who started Olecracy, I think, 7-8 years ago with a couple of hundreds of people, a small part of the very large organization, let's say, and they did it as a revolution. Overnight on Monday, everyone needed to start in new circles and roles, etc. Big change, lots of chaos, but people were kind of forced literally in this new way of working. And for a company with, let's say, a culture of a traditional culture of that style, it was a very fast way to change things. And after 2 or 3 years in this way of working, they had started to behave completely differently. And then teams started to wonder what's next, and they started to take more responsibility for the course of their own team, their own projects, their own clients. So then they evolved into this more incremental evolutionary change. Mm-hmm. And they started pulling in other instruments and tools and ideas. So probably if they wouldn't have the overnight kind of dogmatically forced change at the start, they might have never gotten where they are right now. So mm-hmm. I think it's very hard to generalize here, and it depends on so many different parts of the context. That I'm not in favor of either revolution or evolution. I think you should, again, dance between polarities, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But that's interesting, I think, for our audience to think of polarities. I think it's a concept I've discovered a lot and worked a lot on with integral facilitation. Maybe you're familiar with that. The work of dynamic time. We'll try to have her in the podcast one day.
Okay,
but
great.
Understanding and working with polarities as finding the balance, the idea of finding the right balance for whatever is it wants to emerge. And that's maybe an interesting approach to transformation.
Mm-hmm. And also realizing that it's not a fixed or steady balance. It's kind of like a dynamic balance, because one day you might need a little bit more of one side and the other day you need more of the other side. Yeah. So it's you'll never find that fixed, stable point as a person or an organization. You're always dancing between all polarities to adapt to life in general, I think.
Yeah, so you are not how we call it. Your dream is not to repaint every company, or you're not a believer of anything. You are someone who is more a witness and a host, and you create a space. Or are you? I'm trying to find the appropriate word here.
I do have an image, and that's my subjective image of a better world, right? So
yes.
I do believe in self-organization in general. And so I and we only tend to help organizations that want to evolve towards, let's say, more autonomy for people, being more mindful of purpose, more shared leadership. So that's, it's that direction of growth that we're supporting, right? So
In what way? In what way is it better? I mean, could you articulate that? Why is it self-organizations are needed for a better world? I mean, what is it? You mean better world? I guess you mean a world that is more just, that is more sustainable, that is more...
A world in which both people and organizations can thrive and be successful. And I think both can coexist, because nowadays, sometimes it feels like we have to choose. Either the company is successful by people going over their boundaries and being forced to do stuff, or the other way around. And I think that that both and more is what we need to find. How could we have people kind of swarm together around purposes they care for that are serving the bigger whole, being the society and maybe Earth even? So how can we have people swarm around those purposes to form organizations or reshape existing organizations to kind of steward and push forward the purpose, self-organizing around those purposes, so that each part, so each human being in that group or organization can maximally express his or her talents. Mm-hmm. So maximally contribute to the purpose, therefore maximally contribute to society. Mm-hmm. But also at the same time, by being fully in your own talents, being nourished by the work and by collaborating with people. So it feels like for me, like you could maximally give if you at the same time are maximally nourished by the collaboration and the organization. And I think that's the image I have in my mind. And I think that any organization that in one way or another wants to grow a little bit, maybe even a tiny step towards that, that's the kind of growth I would like to help and support. Yes. Mm. Yeah.
How does it, like in your wildest dream, what is your vision of the future? Like if we pull that string and we towards this logic, you almost pictured a type of organization that is very decentralized, networked, and purpose-centric, but it is not... the borders are maybe much more unclear or much more open than today. You describe organizations that are like different in kind from what we have today, where they, you know, they belong to someone or shareholders and they have very clear limits. What do you see is the, what is coming? Like, how do you see the future of organizations if you follow your dream?
I don't think that at first sight I could add much more to the picture I painted earlier, where indeed boundaries of organizations are less fixed. There's more partnerships spontaneously being created. And maybe just like we see people move from role to team to roles and kind of like find their way within an organization.
Are they still employees or are they all independent ones?
I don't know. And I don't feel mandated to say anything about that because I didn't study those kind of things. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, but I don't think that any, let's say, policies that are limiting people in their growth as human beings is gonna exist in this ideal world. So sometimes being an employee and getting a fixed salary and the stability and comfort and safety that comes along with that is probably for a lot of people the best thing they can have right now. So I'm not dreaming of a world where we're all freelancers or I don't know, right? I don't really have an image around that.
Maybe we can I'd like to pivot to first I want to say this was a tough question and because I think you are really a nice one to think about, but who is thinking of how our organization will look like in 20 years, or if you follow the I would say the philosophy of self-organizations, but also this very major trend. It's a big trend, and it's not just a trend, a fashion. It's also, as we can see, that many companies are now using one more flexible workforce, so they are happy to work with in a different way. We also see that we have to COVID that employees. I don't know if you've seen what Spotify did. Spotify is more like a trendsetter. Of course, not every company is like Spotify, but many actually have been following this year in 2021, where work from anywhere. So remote work has become the new standard.
The new normal, yeah.
New norm. So where yesterday a company meant, used to mean, or an organization used to mean, well, you're an employee, it's an office full of employees who come here from, you know, morning to evening and spend 8 hours or 10 hours a day. And and tomorrow we are talking about an organization is yes, they still are some employees, but there are also a lot of people who are different type of contracts.
I think so, yeah.
And they are not anymore in the walls. They are somewhere else. It's a very profound change.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I think so, yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so let's see how things evolve. But all right, so maybe one of the tools to, and this is the thing, what the tool you're using, and I'm very curious to hear you wrote a book about it, is S3. S3.0, S.0, as you say. Yes, James Priest, co-founder of S3, was a guest of this podcast a few months ago, and there is an interview with him. Everybody can listen. But I just love to hear, because you are someone who actually implement in organizations this approach. You also wrote a book, so which is very hands-on and shows all your experience of it. So maybe for those who didn't hear or listen to James, maybe in a couple of words, what is it? What is S3? What is specific about it? So in a nutshell.
Yeah, great. Well, first thing I'd like to say is go check out the podcast with James, because he's always very inspiring.
Yes, he is.
And he's the one, together with Bernard Bockelbrink and Lily David, who put S3 on the world. And I was one of the happy few to be, like, say, the second generation, getting to know them early on in the journey. For me, S3 is has different definitions and also different layers. So let me start at the most visible layer, let's say, at first sight. So Socracy 3.0, or S3 in short, is a collection of practical, very usable patterns for organizations, for collaborations of any kind. And with patterns, I mean techniques, little processes, small practical things you could pull in. And it's not a methodology you need to all use at once. It's more like a box full of Lego bricks or a menu card with items you could pick and start building stuff with. So definitely the goal should never ever be to implement all of the S3 patterns. There's around 74 or 5. It's more like, what do I want to create in my organization? What are the challenges, and which of those building blocks or patterns I can pull in to use? So there's 75 of those. Some are around decision-making, others around organizational structure. There's a bunch of patterns about personal growth and things like feedback and learning. And there's also patterns about effectively getting work done, to like plan, organize, and do work in an agile way. For me, that's the, let's say, the top layer of S3, the most visible layer. Also a great place to start with Sociocracy 3.0, to pull in one or more of these patterns, start using them, see the effects on the work being done, relationships, but also the effect on yourself. Because for me, that's the invitation within and behind every single pattern. And I think maybe I'll share the anecdote later, but even today we were all surprised about the power of S3 in bringing out what's alive in an organization. So it's obvious, it's like seemingly simple patterns, like little processes to decide something, to select a person for a role, to describe a challenge. It's like these little templates, let's say. But in a way, they almost every time again, they invite people to feel into what's happening within the organization, but even more so within themselves. And so using these patterns typically brings people closer to what is really needed, what's alive in me, more consciousness about what's needed. Sometimes at first shaking up things, because things are being named out that were kind of hidden in the organization, or that were like tensions beneath the surface for many years even. And then starting to apply some of these patterns lets these tensions surface, which is not fun, which is not nice to be in, but it's very sense. What's the word in Dutch? We have a word for that. Sinful. It's very helpful. and very meaningful to go into these things.
What is
so your... that's for me.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was gonna finish. That's for me. Let's say the second layer of Estuary, it increases consciousness of me, myself, the way we collaborate, whether or how I'm contributing to this bigger thing I'm in, etc. Yeah.
What is your maybe your favorite practice? Just also to give an example, make it a bit concrete.
Yeah.
If there is a practice, or you have been, maybe you've been using recently, and you say, "Oh, this is really great." Just to give an example, something you like in particular.
Yeah, I'll share my favorite practice and a concrete example of another practice. Mm-hmm. So I think what my favorite practice is consent decision making, which is a way of making group decisions different from consensus. We're not seeking for all stories and all preferences and all yeses. We're looking for objections that are showing why a proposal isn't safe or good enough for now. And I think it's a great pattern for many reasons. One, because it helps people, groups, make decisions more effectively, typically better decisions, wiser decisions, sometimes faster decisions if it's kind of like a group consensus kind of culture. So it has immediate effect on the work people do and the decisions they make. So it's a pattern that kind of pays back immediately on the surface, but also below the surface, because it confronts people with, wait a minute, I'm not really liking the proposal that's on the table. Why is that? What's happening? Is it my preference? Is there an alternative I would prefer? Is this good enough? What's my objection? What's the difference between an objection and my personal preference here? So it triggers people to become more aware of what they're thinking, what their typical patterns are. And it has a smart way of bringing that into the conversation, because typically after practicing consent for a while, people start talking more and more about their own challenges or patterns or things they could or should be learning. So I think that's very helpful.
One thing I before the example, I just bounce with you on this. I heard a video about decision making by consent, and the person was saying it's actually about reasoning. You know, if the collective was a brain, and every brain was a cell, or in the brain or part of the brain, it's like it's collective intelligence reasoning, because we are exchanging, reasonable argument. It cannot be preferences and unreasonable argument. So there is something about participating in a good reasoning. And it's maybe a way to explain it that can resonate for many.
I can reason
very well as a collective, as a team, to take effectively like wise decisions and optimal decisions.
I like that way of describing it. If people interpret reasoning in the right way, because in Dutch we might interpret it as discussing. And I don't think consent is about discussing, not in the sense of I need to defend my point of view and show you that I'm right. No, on the contrary, we're learning and actively discovering that there's a lot of wisdom in your opinion and possible objection, which we'll qualify later on, right? So what's the wisdom in each one of us, and how could we learn about that, bring those pieces of wisdom on the table? That's the reasoning you're talking about. And then by having all these reasons or chunks of wisdom on the table, the better solution shows itself spontaneously.
Right? You know, we brought this practice to the leadership team of a large company, very large group. So we're talking with the CEO and the leadership team.
Okay.
And they're using this, and they said that it was both creative and disciplined. And they liked it a lot.
Two polarities.
Yeah, exactly. Two polarities. And they say, It's frustrating because now because the process is very structured, and so it cannot be those endless debates that they used to have. But at the same time, they feel they include everyone better and they take much faster decisions. And they just want everybody the company to know about it anyway.
Yeah.
So that's just a little story to bring an example around.
And I like it because it's indeed creative. If we appreciate the wisdom in each other's objections,
yeah,
then you need to be creative, and you're invited to become more creative, to combine them and find the both and more solution. Yeah.
So that was the like the one you prefer the most, and you said that I have two others with examples. I'm curious.
Well, there's one anecdote I wanted to share because we discussed it in our team this morning. It was from Bart, one of my colleagues, also organizational coach. And he was applying role or teaching actually role selection to an organization last week. And role selection is a small process in which you could use to select a person for a role or a group of people to become a team, or you could even use it to select different vendors or products to select something or someone. And they were using it on a fake example as a teaching exercise. They were selecting someone to, what was it, to post something on social media about the course, just to practice the process. And the people were nominating other people and explaining their reasons. Then they were looking for consent at the end of the process. And no one had an objection. And then one person had a concern. And the person said, yeah, well, blah, blah, blah. And the concern was about, yeah, and since you have enough time for it. And the person that was addressed and that was called to have enough time for this assignment started to cry.
Wow.
Yeah, really, because, yeah, something touched her about having enough time in that organization, because apparently it was an organization with the culture of you need to be very busy to mean something in this organization. If you're not busy, 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 you're not working a lot of hours, you're not valuable in this organization. And so someone assuming that she would have extra time kind of touched on something very important for her, and attention that was lying around in the team probably for years. And so by even by practicing an S3 pattern on fake material, so a fake case, not even a real life case in that team, the real life tensions that are alive in the team or in these people were triggered. And we had an intervision session about that this morning where Bart brought in this case. And we all recognized again, like, wow, that's indeed the power of S3 patterns. And secondly, we as facilitators need to be aware of this and also be ready to recognize these tensions when they show up and handle them and work on those with the group.
Wow.
And so, again, not only being the teacher, but then switching in the dance to being the coach or facilitator. To help this group learn about this tension and handle it.
Yeah.
So it was very meaningful to, again, discover and discuss this morning. Yeah.
Maybe it would be, if you could tell us about the book. Maybe tell us, if you could pitch the book and tell us what is this book about. I pitch a little bit about it, but tell us is this book about?
It's a novel, so it's a story. It's a fictive story about an organization that has some typical growth problems, slow decision making, etc., and quality dropping of the products they build. And the somewhat older CEO realizes that it's time for a new CEO and asks one of the young middle managers to step in as a CEO. And this young manager, Chris, he's called. Accepts the challenge, but after talking with Bernie, who is an experienced sociocracy practitioner, and so Bernie starts coaching this Chris in his role as a new CEO and starts working with the leadership team to discover the real challenges and implement S3 patterns. So that's basically the story, and if you read the book, you'll discover all things happening to this leadership team and whether or not the company survives and thrives. So I kind of gathered a lot of examples I run into in all different clients I was able to support the last years, like the typical challenge both organizations and leaders run into. And I try to weave them into a story that teaches the readers Sociocracy 3.0.
Mm.
So my intention with the book was make an accessible, easy to read introduction to Sociocracy 3.0. So I'm not covering every single depth and detail. That was not my intention, but showing the basics in a story, because I love reading these business novels myself all my life. I liked stories to read, to learn stuff. And so the moment I decided to write something, I spontaneously started this this type of book, let's say. Yeah.
I have the book, I read it, and I like the depths that you bring and the subtlety that you have. Different characters, some members of the team are not so happy about what's going on.
Indeed,
you have the real, it shows it's a good reflection of what you can really meet in a team.
Thanks.
And also the way that Bernie and what's the name of the new CEO? Sorry, you said it,
Chris.
Chris. Yes.
Yeah.
Bernie's, this is an amazing coach. And how they approach those situations is very unconventional, I find, for me as a consultant, and very deep and very effective at the same time. So I really strongly recommend the book. It's on Amazon or any other platform?
Yes, definitely. Yeah, if any platform, if you would Google on Google or go to Amazon and you're right.
Yeah, I would put it on the description of the
Sociocracy.
Sociocracy 3.0, the novel. I would put it on the description of the
of
this podcast, and people can find it.
That's great. Yeah,
I'm curious to. I know that writing a book is also it's something meaningful in one's life when you write. I think, is it your first book? Mm-hmm.
Yes, first book I ever wrote. Yeah.
So it's an achievement. It's also a self-expression. It's you kind of coming to the world and say, "Hey, world, this is me. I have something to share." So maybe tell us a bit, what does it mean for you writing this book a bit more on a personal level, if you're okay with that?
Yeah, maybe I'll start with how it started, because I've been reading a lot as a child. And I remember as a teenager having the dream of maybe I'll one day write a book. So there was this hidden dream somewhere for many years. And then I started writing a blog when I was working in my 20s, enjoying writing blog articles, learning from that. But then kind of the dream not disappeared, but wasn't so, let's say, active anymore. And I remember one day that James and Bernard and Lily were bringing S3 into the world, and a lot of people were kind of complaining, even in a way that it wasn't properly described yet at that early stage. And I remember saying to a colleague, like, someone should write something about S3. and later that evening, I was like, maybe I should try to write something. And so it wasn't a plan of I'm going to write a book. Initially, I was trying to write something for my colleagues and peers and maybe some customers. Initially, I never thought of it as a real published book that would be in physical and online stores. So I think maybe that's even the strength of it, because it was kind of like a spontaneous personal project. I literally sat on the couch and started on the first chapter one evening. And it was only a couple of weeks later, when I had a couple of chapters and a storyline, that I began thinking of, hey, maybe this could become a real story. And then I wrote the story, and then James helped me a lot to kind of reorder things and deepen some of the patterns here and there. And then I think it took me a year and a half on and off writing a bit in my spare time before I realized, hey, the story could be valuable to more people than just five colleagues and a client. Then I approached a publisher, and then he also appreciated it. And then it became a real book, right? Because initially I wasn't even, maybe I was dreaming about it, but not believing yet in that or aiming for it. So that's how it grew on me, the book. And it's only by publishing it that I remember by signing the contract that I only then realized, like, oh my God, I really wrote a book. And indeed, it's a part of me. It's a part of expressing me. And at the same time, because the English version is out for 2 years, but the Dutch version is out for almost 4 years now, I think. And at the same time, I'm happy to feel right now that I'm much more than just a book, right? Yes, sure, I'm the author of the book, and I hope a lot of people can benefit from it, sure. But I'm also much more than that. I'm more than just the book or the author of... So I'm very grateful for that experience. And sometimes people ask me, when will the second book be there? But it's not something I plan for. Maybe it happens one day, but we'll see.
If there was another book, what would it be about? Do you know already?
No, there's no concrete
yet.
Ideas. No. I have concrete ideas about workshops I'd like to do, or courses, or communities, but no books at this point in time. Yeah.
Mm. And I'm curious to ask you, we didn't talk so much about Eileen. I'm curious to how you you founded this company. Mm-hmm. And we understand that your approach is rooted in a lot of expertise, but also in an approach that is like a coaching approach, or how do you transmit that? How did you do to go out of just being yourself but create a team and transmit this approach to that is working at different levels to your team members and maintain that culture and that approach, so it's not just you but it's a company we can deliver.
Uh-huh. Well, it's funny you ask, because it's a very vulnerable topic at this moment, because we're maybe I should explain some of the history. It's been, I think, almost 15 years we started Eileen, initially with Chris and later Dieter. So the three of us are the founders, let's say, to help organizations become really agile and implement the agile techniques such as Scrum, etc. Later on, we evolved to organizational change, culture change, self-organization. We included S3 in our toolbox, etc. But in a way, we are very successful, as in we provide really high quality courses, and our colleagues are really experienced coaches doing awesome things at our clients. So we're really valuable for our clients. I feel confident in saying that. But from another perspective, I don't feel so successful, because as an entrepreneur, we have split the company in two teams, and our team is only 5 or 6 people right now. While if you would look from a distance at the market and the amount of requests or needs, implicit or explicit, for coaching and guidance and self-organization, one might say, hey, why aren't you 50 people or 100 people? So I'm having difficulties finding myself or the company successful, because we're not having the impact we potentially could have because of small size. Mm. And that's one of the struggles we're facing for years. We're all, sometimes we say, or I say, like, I'm not an entrepreneur. I'm like a really good trainer and coach that needs the organization to be able to do my work, right?
You're more an artist than an entrepreneur, maybe.
Yeah.
An artist, what you do.
Yeah. But then if you put 6 artists together, they can make great stuff, but they don't know how to manage and run themselves and create a larger organization. So that's the struggle we're in. And at the same time, that's the growth we're in as an organization, but also as people. Every year we discover more about what's my strength, what can we learn, how to embrace new people that bring in new qualities. Like this year we started with Els, who brought in a totally different energy into the organization. And sometimes I think, why didn't we do this 5 years ago? And then I realized, because I wasn't ready for this 5 years ago. So again, it's not the external obstacle, it's my own process finally allowing me to learn these new things. So it's at the same time remarkable, but also frustrating in a way, the degree in which personal growth of the leaders defines where an organization can get.
Mm. And then we have to accept that for ourselves.
It's tough. I think it's tough.
So if everything is possible, where are you in 5 years from now?
Me or Eileen?
You.
I think if everything would be possible in 5 years, I would still be helping organizations to become better places.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know exactly in what way, but I would hope I would, together with friends, colleagues, partners, would be able to have even much more impact. So to help much more organizations at the same time, or I don't know how, but I'm envisioning the same kind of job, but in an even more impactful way. I don't have any more concrete image of that, but
more scaling.
Not necessarily scaling as in amount of people and amount of clients. That could definitely be part of it. But also the quality of the impact and the sustainability. It's kind of like Michelle, one of your other guests, made a difference between growing and thriving. So my aim is not necessarily to grow Eileen in the number of people or the number of clients or the turnover, but to have every, including me, every person within Eileen, including me, but also all clients, to be thriving more in 5 years from now. That would be the goal.
Yeah. Bringing more life and more health and more energy to your to wherever it's needed and to your ecosystem.
Definitely.
The
society,
the companies, the clients.
And of course, I think growth in the amount of people we collaborate with is part of that, but not the goal or something.
Maybe I want to ask you what we as we end this conversation to. What we ask to our every guest is 2 minutes to say whatever you want, and to it's your moment of I would say full freedom, but intimacy as well to whoever is listening in I don't know which distance in time and geography, but those people again that are interested in everything you've shared and maybe are has been awakened by some of things you said and inspired. So 2 minutes, I will cut my mic and remove my headset. So it's you alone. I don't know what you're gonna say. are you up for that?
I think so. It's kind of scary at the same time, but let's go.
All right. So it's you. Okay. So see you in a minute. 2 minutes.
The first thing I'll do, and I'm going to invite you, dear listener, to do the same thing, is let's just breathe a couple of times and listen into what our body is telling us right now. So let's do that together. And what comes to me feeling into the conversation I just had with Mikhail is vulnerability as a gate, as an opening, as an entrance to growth and to more joy in life and work, to more success in life and work. So I would invite all of you and myself to be more aware of these small and bigger vulnerabilities inside of ourselves, because they tell us something. They want to show something. We need to care for them, understand what's alive, and with people whom we feel safe to do so, share and learn. Because typically behind these vulnerabilities inside of ourselves are great things just waiting to emerge. So as a reminder for myself and an invitation to all of you, let's listen more to our bodies, because it's typically our emotions and our sensory observations, let's say, within our body or our system that are revealing these things. So let's all be more attentive and aware of those for a more joyful and a better life.
I'm back, Jeff. Thank you.
Mikhail, for having me.
I feel like Colombo, because you know Colombo leaves and he comes back and say, "Hey, by the way, I have a last question."
All right.
There's something I forgot to ask you.
Okay, go ahead.
You told me that you are you used to play in a band, guitar.
Yeah,
and then sing.
I do.
And you still have a guitar, and you also told me that it helped you becoming a better trainer.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah,
I was just curious.
Well,
in what way?
I played in a band when I was 16 or 17 years old, and I was learning to play guitar. And then the singer left the band, and the bass player, the drummer, and I were left over. And we said, like, who's going to be the singer? And we did the contest, like, who's the best singer? And I kind of, actually, the question was, who's the least worst singer? Because I couldn't sing at that point in time. So I became the singer, and I took singing classes, and I learned to how to physically stand on a stage, how to use my throat muscles, my voice, how to articulate. I took some classes in how to engage with an audience, all as a singer, right? And we were never a great band, and I was never a great singer, but I did learn a lot of things, which only years later, when I started to teach more and more in a professional context, that I discovered how natural it felt to be in this role and to talk to people and to engage an audience and project my voice and hold space for a group. And so I think I learned a lot of those skills by being part of a band, because you need to together play the music, and listening to the other musicians is even more important than playing your own instrument in a way. So it's about collaboration on one hand, and on the other hand, I've learned to be the singer and take the stage and the place. So yeah, I learned a lot from that, which I use when I'm dancing between the trainer and the coach and the facilitator roles professionally. Yeah, definitely.
You found your own art.
Yeah.
An expression.
Yes.
Thank you for sharing that. Okay, so it was really great having you. We have been discussing about different things, about transformation in organization, and about S3, and about your book, and about Eileen, and about yourself. And it was really sweet having you, a really nice spending time with you.
Thanks, I liked it too.
And I wish you the best for the future, for you, for Eileen, and for all your projects and all your long-term dreams. And for, so bye, my friend. And for those who are listening to us tonight or today, whenever it is, we hope this inspired you. And wish you really all the best, and apply S3 is definitely an interesting approach. I really recommend you to read the book. And if you're in Belgium, Eileen could definitely be also a great company to help you. If you're a company, let's make a bit of advertising for you, Jeff. awesome. And yes, and let's stay tuned for our next episode. Bye.
Hope to see you again soon, Mikael.
Me too. Bye.
Bye-bye.